Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I've always liked the concept of farmers markets, but it wasn't until I hit Vermont shores that I really became a dedicated market attendee. Living in Montpelier, I could grab my man purse and head to the market on Saturday mornings throughout the summer. When they added the winter farmers market, I was on board with that as well. Moving to Chittenden County, I became a regular at the Burlington Farmers Market, but I've also gladly patronized the markets in Essex, Winooski, the Islands, and Richmond, and I've even had an opportunity to attend Brattleboro's. I dig them all, big or small. There's always something that I must have, and meeting farmers, artists, food producers, and beer or spirits makers, it's amazing to see the great pride they take in their wares. With me today are a couple of people who know all about these markets. Cindy Walcott is past president of the Champlain Islands Farmers Market. Cindy, thank you for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you.
And Mieko Ozeki is the former market director of the Burlington Farmers Market and is an advisory board member of the Vermont Farmers Market Association. Mieko, great to have you here as well.
Hello.
Hello. And listeners, if you'd like to share what you've experienced at your farmers market this year, or you have a question to ask our guests, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Cindy, as difficult a year as it's been for all of us, how do you think farmers markets did overall?
Well, I can speak obviously most familiarly with the Champlain Islands Farmers Market, and I would have to say that all in all, we had a very challenging but very successful year. So I feel very positive about it. We got off to a very rocky start with farmers markets across the state because we had no guidance essentially on how we if we were going to be able to operate and under what circumstances. But once we got that guidance, farmers markets across the state figured out how to make things work, and I think most markets did fairly well.
Mieko, what's your assessment of how farmers markets did this year?
I agree with Cindy. Overall, for the Burlington Farmers Market, it has gone well. And I think for us, success has been a really safe market, both for our customers and for our vendors.
And Mieko, for those not familiar with the Burlington Farmers Market, tell us about the displacement that the summer market has undergone over these past 2 years.
Sure. So the Burlington Farmers Market have relocated to 345 Pine Street, and it was for 2 years while the City Hall Park was under construction. And I think for us, it really worked out, actually, in terms of the pandemic, having an open parking lot had worked out for us to handle all of the new kind of COVID guidance. So it's been an interesting journey, but it was a silver lining in this year.
Absolutely. Does the farmers market plan to move back to City Hall Park in 2021?
It's my understanding we are kind of still working out details in regards to a return, but also just I think in light of COVID, we're still kind of trying to keep our options open.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to predict just about anything yet for 2021 because the pandemic might be in control with the vaccine rollout, but we still have this incredible surge of cases. So it's almost unfair to ask questions about the future, and I apologize for that. Cindy, the Champlain Islands market is a little different because it meets twice a week in the summer in two locations. Why is it done that way?
Well, we started off 20 years ago with a location in Aalborg, actually, and then we moved to South Hero. And as the market grew, particularly since we have the advantage of summer visitors in most years, The market board decided that we could actually support two markets a week. So the Saturday market is in Grand Isle, which picks up more of the northern part of the islands, and the Wednesday market is in South Hero, which picks up southerners, so to speak, southern towns, and also people who are at the Grand Isle campground, the state campground. We find that we have about twice the number of customers at the Saturday market, but the Wednesday market is still a very healthy market.
And you continued that this summer as well during the pandemic?
We did. And as a matter of fact, interestingly enough, the Saturday market suffered more from a decline in customers than did the Wednesday market.
Oh, interesting. Now, Mieko, at its peak, how many vendors has the Burlington Farmers Market had?
In a regular year, we typically have about 85 to 90. And then during COVID, we had half that number. Around our peak was about 45 to 46 vendors.
And did you keep it at that number, that 45 or 46, because of spacing of the booths, or was that just some not coming back because of the uncertainty of the pandemic?
Well, fortuitously, actually, it's both. So in terms of the spacing, it did limit in terms of our, you know, making ample room in the lot that we are in. And so we calculated, given kind of the space restrictions, that we could have up to about 50. But it worked out that in terms of our returning vendors and the ones that we had accepted, it worked out to a number of about 55 accepted, and some of those were kind of part like full season, and then some of them were just like they just wanted to be day vendors.
Mm-hmm. And explain what that concept of day vendors means.
Sure. Yeah. So there, and all markets are very different in terms of how they designate their vendors. So we have three levels of vendors. We have a body called our vendor members. These are our permanent members who pay dues and have had a long standing at the market. So they have a permanent spot that they get to select in March. And then we have another set that are our provisional vendors, people who have to apply over and over again, and they get to occupy a spot. They're kind of given the next choice in terms of spaces. Mm-hmm. And then our day vendors are really, usually they're mostly new vendors who, it's kind of their trial run, and they fill in for whenever one of our other seasonal vendors are not able to be in their space.
Yeah, I had to be educated on that, because I'll find a new vendor and I'll get all excited, and then they won't be there the following week, and my heart is broken.
Exactly.
And I thought, why didn't I buy more of their stuff the week before? And then they explained to me, we'll see, I'm a day vendor. And so
right.
If ever that happens to you, listeners, that's what's going on. Sometimes it's a matter of being a day vendor. They will be back at times, kind of pop up and in and out during the season. But, yeah, take their card when it's there, and find out, you know, how to contact them when they're not at the farmer's market. Cindy, how about in the islands? What's the normal amount of vendors you have and the amount you had this summer?
In 2019, we had 36 full-season vendors. And so that would be similar to the Burlington market. These are people that have signed up, pay dues, pay for the entire season. This year, we only had 20. So, you know, it was a little over half. And this was primarily driven by the spacing requirements, which when the Agency of Agriculture put out their initial guidance on April 24th, they required 12-foot spacing between tents.
Mm-hmm.
And so our market and markets across the state really had to do their math. And we figured out, for instance, at our Saturday market, we could only accommodate 18 vendors to meet the spacing requirements, whereas last year we usually typically would have 32.
For all those people who said, when are we going to use this math in real life, right?
Yes.
We're going to talk about another math subject, Cindy. How was attendance and sales generally between 2019 and 2020?
Our market has actually for the last 3 years done formal customer counts once a month at each of our markets.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we found this year was that the Saturday market overall had about 72% of the customers, and the Wednesday market had about 85% of the customers.
Wow.
So that would translate for us to about 500 customers on Saturday and about 200 on Wednesday.
Nice. Mieko, how about you in Burlington? What happened between 2019 and 2020?
Sure. We have done customer counts in the past, and so we always calculate around about 7,000 to 8,000 customers coming per season, and majority of that, I would say half of that being tourists during the summer seasons. But this year we did more, because we had to control the crowds that came into our market, we right. counted. And so at our peak, we had about 2,800.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously about a quarter. But the thing about it is what we saw in expenditures was that people, and because of based on the vendors that we had there, most people were there just intent to shop, right? So they were it's a little bit more focused than just kind of checking it out, because there's a lot to prepare to get yourself on a line in the market,
mm-hmm.
waiting for your turn to get in. You have to be pretty much intentional about your shopping.
Absolutely. Mieko, did you find any positives coming out of this scaled down market this year?
Sure. I think we learned that not all farmers are not coders. In particular, I mean this in a good sense. So
yes.
One of the requirements that was of us was pre-ordering. And so that meant it could be by phone, it could be by email, but majority of our vendors had to go and join the 21st century, update their website, maybe have a social media presence. And so that really was a big leap, but it was a way for one of the advantages of that was that they had guaranteed sales when they came into a market that they were pretty uncertain about. So pre-ordering was a really kind of the silver lining, because it also had a lot of our vendors reckoning with the fact that they do need to have an online presence. And so it's been great in some ways. Some people were like, I never thought of selling online.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Cindy, any silver linings in the islands?
You know, I think Mieko mentioned earlier that customers that came to the market were really intentional about being there. And so what we found is that for vendors who had been at the market last year and then had came back to the market this year, for that group of people, sales were up, so they about 110% of what they were last year. I will also say that those intentional customers that came through were by and large so grateful that we were there to provide a safe environment for them to buy fresh, healthy food. And they articulated that to people that were orienting them at the gate, to our vendors. And so it became an even more rewarding experience for us being a part of the island's community.
I can definitely see why sales go up for returning vendors, because even when it's a full market, I pretty much know where I'm going, what I need that week, who to hit. But I do have a rule that at least once a month I have to buy from a new vendor, so that I get to try out. And it might be an artist, it might be a farmer, it might be some prepared food, but I have to try something new every once in a while and kind of introduce myself to another vendor. But we do kind of fall into a pattern and go to the same vendors. And, you know, if they return year after year, week after week, we really start to develop that pattern. Cindy, you mentioned the governor announcing the rules for the farmers markets. When that happened, was there enough time to put the changes in place? And how long did it take to kind of pivot at that point?
Well, I would say we were all scrambling. But on the other hand, you know, when things went haywire, let us say, in March, So what happened at that point in time is that the winter markets that were then operating were essentially shut down unless they could change to a pre-order curbside pickup only. So, you know, we already knew that there was this potentially we were going to have to go to a pre-order curbside pickup. And I will say that the farmers markets in Vermont and across the nation started networking very heavily and sharing experiences about what they had been able to put in place very short order. Here in Vermont, NOFA Vermont does some facilitation of the farmers market managers and board members. And so we were really, I really felt like we were in it together and were able to learn from each other. So our board ordinarily would be meeting once a month. We were meeting at least once a week during that period of time, trying to figure out what end was up and how we could pull our market off. One of the things that happened also was that at first the Agency of Ag said we could that only food could be sold at markets. So we had to tell all of our crafters and artisans that had applied and were accepted that they could not attend the market. And then that guidance changed somewhat. So we were scrambling again. So, you know, you understand that what we were talking about, and this is true across all industries in Vermont, that the ground was shifting and it was really required of us to be adaptable, quick on our feet, try to maintain a sense of humor with our vendors who were trying to get set up to do all of the things that they needed to do comply with the guidelines, the masking, the sanitation, the display models that prohibited customers from touching their wares, which is very different from a typical farmer's market. So all of those things were very challenging, and they changed on a fairly regular basis during the season. So we were just constantly trying to rework our procedures, market overall and also for each vendor.
Mieko, how did you adjust there in Burlington?
I mean, Cindy basically pointed out some of the kind of a similar timeline for us. We had to cancel our winter market in March at UVM Davis Center, and naturally, fortuitously, it worked out because then they had to shut down as well. So, you know, we ended up not having a market, but that gave us a lot of time. And I think Cindy made a really great point. We kind of gathered together as market managers, both in the state and also nationally, to kind of learn and support one another. Mm-hmm. And for us, one of the things that our steering committee early on was, well, May sales are generally, they're pretty down. They're usually plant starts and everything else. So they decided that we would push back our 40th anniversary year. We would push back our first day of the season by 1 month because we figured that June was kind of when things were coming, there was going to be more things available. And so that actually worked out for us because it gave us a little bit longer time to, I think we went through this gradual process. We had to talk, we had done a space meeting with all of our vendors who selected spaces, and then we had the shutdown, and then kind of going through this process of just keeping our vendors apprised of what was going on, right, as we're all learning, you know, about what market guidelines and everything else. And there was a lot of pain. You know, we had to tell craft people that they couldn't come, and then that suddenly changed. But what was wonderful about this was that we were learning as other models were coming about throughout the state, throughout the country, curbside, online pre-ordering. We were learning from all these other markets. So by the time we started, we were actually well underway. We kind of like saw the pros and cons of different models, and we're able to kind of get started right away. We had a couple of hiccups, but for the most part, we've learned the lessons from other vendors and other markets across the state and across the country.
Now, you mentioned that you were in touch with other markets around the state. After 9:30, we will take a break, and we'll touch base with Kerry Ryan of the Montpelier Farmers Market, the Capital City Farmers Market. But, Mieko, what have you heard from other markets in Vermont on how things went in 2020?
I think it was, one of it was, a little bit of panic about who was going to come. That was first vendors. And most of us are looking in terms of the categories, what can we offer our customers? I think the other concern that we just came up when we, for our managers, was how can we be a food distribution area for low-income families? And that was really key to us in terms of being able to have enough variety for those customers to be able to have access to food. And so those kind of a lot of different issues were coming up. But one of the things that market managers as a whole, we were just all trying to figure out how to best serve different populations.
And Cindy, shoppers that came to the market, what motivated them to buy, from local food producers this year? What were you hearing from people who were turning out?
I think first and foremost, it was about feeling safe and also wanting to really support the local businesses in our area. In the islands, we have no full-service grocery store, so there was also, an economic component in that people didn't have to drive to the mainland in order to get the food products that they valued.
Mieko, there were food supply chain issues. There were concerns about COVID at meat producers in other parts of the country. Were these things you were hearing from your shoppers, your attendees, coming to buy from local purveyors?
Obviously, because of social distancing, you only hear a little bit from customers. So,
right.
So with that said, in numbers, looking at our vendors, I would, almost every week we would see our vegetable as well as our meat providers had to restock several times, as well as, eggs was a huge commodity. I actually remember one of our vendors was asked by a customer, is two cartons of the limit? Because they were so used to the supermarket limiting the supply of eggs. And then also dairy. And we had one seafood provider and he sold out right away. So it's interesting because people were stocking up as much as they possibly could because to get that high quality food and because they trusted it a lot.
And there's nothing like meeting the person who, is responsible for those eggs and that meat and that cheese face-to-face at a farmer's market. We're discussing the role farmer's markets play in Vermont's food economy. We're going to pop out for a CBS News update, then return to the discussion. Like I said, Kerry Ryan will join us of the Montpelier Farmer's Market. You can call to speak with our guests at 244-1777. Toll-free 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and it's Market Day here on WDEV. I'm speaking with Mieko Ozeki, the former market director of the Burlington Farmers Market, and Cindy Walcott, the past president of the Champlain Islands Farmers Market. Joining us now for the next few minutes is the market manager of the Capital City Farmers Market in Montpelier, Kerry Ryan. Kerry, I'm so glad you could join us today.
Hi, Rick. Thanks so much for having all of us.
Yeah.
Hi to Mieko and Cindy. The three of us have spent a lot of time on conference calls over the last 8 months.
Oh, I bet. Well, Kerry, what were kind of the highlights of the summer market season once it got started there in Montpelier?
boy, it was a really interesting season. I actually only joined the market this year, so it was an interesting welcome to the job. But we were blown away by the community support, the customers that are so loyal to these vendors and came out all summer with all of the hoops that we made them jump through just to come visit us at the market. It was really amazing to see how people turned out. And our vendors and our board was incredibly dedicated. I mean, when we got shut down in March, we spent the entire month of April with the board trying to figure out plan A, plan B, plan C. They put in so much time above and beyond what should ever be asked of them. And it was a really successful season. I had a lot of vendors that say they had their highest sales ever.
Wow, that's great to hear. What percentage of your normal vendors total did you have this year?
Well, like Nieko said, a fraction. But a normal summer season, I'd say we probably would have 60 to 70 vendors. This year, because of both space requirements and the fact that a lot of vendors wanted to sit it out and see how it went, we averaged probably 40.
And could you tell if your weekly attendance was up or down from past years?
Well, certainly down, probably half of what it was last year.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like both ladies said, the people that were there to shop. They were there to spend money. So our sales weren't down drastically. Attendance was, I think our highest attendance day was 1,400, which was pretty amazing. That was shortly after our move to 133 State Street. So, yeah, people came out, and they came out because they wanted to support these vendors, and they really wanted to spend their money there.
So where is the new location? It used to be between Julio's and the church there on State Street, but where is it now?
Yeah, we had an interesting challenge with locations this year. We had moved from the Julio's lot, or the Heaney lot, over to Taylor Street, which turned out to be a construction disaster. So thankfully, our members voted to move again in the middle of the season, which is a good way to kill a market sometimes, but
yep.
our customers are so amazing that they found us no matter where we went. So our new and permanent location now, thankfully, is 133 State Street, just west of the Capitol Building, next to the tax department. It's the tax department parking lot, and it's a beautiful lot. As far as parking lots go, I've never been so excited about a beautiful parking lot before.
Well, Mieko, I think you would probably say the same thing. You know, if having to leave City Hall Park, the Burlington Farmers Market, and finding a place to have it, having the parking lot that you did on Pine Street really turned out to be very positive in the last couple of years for y'all.
Yes. I mean, before we transitioned over there, we had looked at 17 sites throughout Burlington. And so we were lucked out at the very end that dealer.com had let us sublease their parking lot, and they've helped maintain it. And when it comes to being, you know, 12 feet apart, 6 feet apart in terms of tents and people, it works out to have a very blank plate to be working with.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about winter farmers markets as well. First of all, Cindy, has the Champlain Islands farmers market, have you done in the past, or do you do winter farmers markets?
Yes. In the last 4 or 5 years, we have done winter markets just in November and December, two markets each month. This year, however, we made the decision back in September that we were not going to be able to do a winter market because our normal location being a church basement was just not going to allow us to maintain the type of spacing that was required for vendor and customer safety. So we sat the winter market out this season, unfortunately.
Yeah. And Carrie, Montpelier started it, oh gosh, I'm going to think it's about 15 years ago, started a winter farmers market. What in a normal non-COVID year, what was the normal kind of schedule and where was it held in Montpelier?
Well, I speak for last year, we were hosted by Bar Hill, Caledonia Spirits at their distillery, just down in Montpelier, which was an amazing location for us. They were extremely generous. we could fit about 25 vendors in there. It was tight, and it's a pretty cozy space. So obviously that was out off the table. And we looked at a lot of online ordering systems for this winter, to move to an online system with just a pickup location. But at the end of the day, what was really important to us was the in-person shopping. It's really the heart of the market. It's especially in this socially distanced COVID days. It really is part of what keeps the community alive. So we felt like we were losing the whole idea of a farmer's market by switching to online. So I'm actually very excited to say that we just announced yesterday that we are going to continue to do an outdoor market for the rest of the winter season, starting in January, every second and fourth Saturday of the month. What made our minds up, we had a market on December 19th. It was -6 degrees when I showed up in the morning. And we still had all of our vendors show up and all of our customers came out. And again, I had vendors that sold out with record sales. And we said, you know what? These are true Vermonters. We mm-hmm. can do this.
Wow.
So we will be outdoors.
That is exciting news. I know you had the two, one right before Thanksgiving, one right before Christmas, as you said, December 19th. I attended the pre-Thanksgiving one, and I waited. I got there. It was only 10:45. It opened at 10. And by that time, the line was all the way down State Street, and I happily waited in line and enjoyed attending that farmer's market. So well
Thank
done.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. I couldn't believe it when I stepped out just before market opened. And that's my favorite thing about market, even with the COVID restrictions, having a controlled entry. And I'm able to say hello to everybody as they come in. Mm-hmm. And I stepped out to the entrance and I couldn't believe the line that was down the block. And I felt so terribly that you guys had to wait. But thank you for waiting so patiently. And
you know how Vermonters are. Everybody was just chatting, talking about what Thanksgiving was going to be like. Now, Mieko, in Burlington, you did the same thing. You had a pre-Thanksgiving, a pre-Christmas winter's farmer's market, and I attended the pre-Christmas one in Burlington. It was 11 degrees when I got there, and it felt like the middle of the summer. It felt like it was just like shopping at the regular summer farmer's market, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, weirdly enough, this year, weather has worked out. And I was originally nervous about us doing it out in the lot, but you know, we didn't really have a choice in terms of indoor locations. And so we were lucky enough to extend and be in that lot. And so it was wonderful to see we had, you know, just under 1,000 people come, but everyone was very intentional about what they were shopping for.
Yeah.
Our pre-Thanksgiving, I was thinking one of the things that we all kind of commented about among managers was like, how did we luck out with 40-degree weather?
Yeah.
I think we were really, really fortunate.
It was. Hey, let's go to the phones and talk to Charlie in Brookfield. And I should mention, you've got a little farmer's market in Brookfield. I've been to that one, too. I forgot. So I didn't mean to slight the folks down that way. The Floating Bridge Farmer's Market, I believe it's called. Charlie, go right ahead.
Yeah, they canceled that for this year. We've only done it once during the summer for the last couple of years.
Gotcha.
So they didn't have it. It was in, we do farmers markets in both Northfield and Randall.
Mm-hmm.
And we do them year round. We do farm products. That's what we do.
Yep.
Vegetables and beef. And we found that one of the things that they said in there was people come to buy.
Yeah.
Our sales were down by 15% or better between the two of them. One's better than the other sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to do a winter's market. We had to cancel because it was in a church basement and it just wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
And we in Northfield have gone to an online working with a system called Eats from Farms, mm-hmm. Farmers, and this was our third one this week, and I am really impressed.
Oh, wow.
People are buying, I mean, for us, it's not like Burlington, it's not like Montpelier, we're
sure.
Small, and it's working quite well. When my wife's a big, very big part of this, probably the bigger part. And we just all came come to an end in March, and I started putting things on Front Porch Forum and some of these sales things on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And we started doing a very good delivery service right in the Randolph area. I couldn't do much. Something just didn't work in Northfield. But in Randolph, we had 6 or 8 customers every week.
Wow.
And they were buying a fair amount of stuff. So, but I had to deliver it. But
yep.
Still, it's not that far and it's not that bad. Plus, we did places like a hospital or a parking lot where they could pick it up.
Yep. Hey, Charlie, what's the name of your farm there in Brookfield?
Floating Bridge Family Farm.
Oh, there we go. Floating Bridge Family Farm. Hey, thanks so much for joining us and letting us know your story. And, Cindy, that was gold to hear from Charlie. But how important are these farmers markets to the farmers and the participating vendors?
They are, I would say, very, very, very important. For a farmer's market, we often will serve as kind of an incubator for new businesses. For our vendors, it's relatively inexpensive to participate in a farmer's market. So they're able to kind of test the waters. And in the years that I've been involved in our market, I've seen farmers come in, establish themselves, and really be able to expand. So it's very key for them. And also, you talked about that personal connection between the customer and the farmer.
Yeah.
I think that counts for a lot, especially these days. People really want to know where their food comes from. They want to know that it's safe and healthy, and they get that at the farmer's market.
Yeah, and you have a good point of, it introduces you to some vendors who then go on, they kind of outgrow it. I think of Mount Mansfield Creamery, they were at the Burlington Farmers Market years ago. That's how I found that cheese and became addicted. Von Trapp's cheese as well. Those are just some that have started at a farmer's market, and then I have to go seek them out. Mieko, the one thing that Cindy was mentioning about that kind of being an incubator, who is right? The vendor, who is right to be at the farmer's market? Is it startups, established products, prepared foods, nanobreweries, artists? What do you think?
Well, I would say all, and again, it all depends on, it depends on which farmer's market you're applying to, right? Everyone has a different kind of curated standard for being part of the farmer's market. So that way, when the experience for the customer, you don't have to ask, is this from Vermont? Is this sourced in Vermont? Is this made in Vermont?
Yeah.
So those are one of the things I think that folks want to keep in mind. Like, this is the work of what market managers and our steering committees and our vendors, what we do to secure that kind of brand identity. But I think it's wonderful is that, we get emails all the time for applications. Folks are like, I just started XYZ, and you try kind of filtering and figuring out, like, is this appropriate for them to apply and then to be reviewed? Some of us have tested their products before. We also just hear from customers whether once they've gone through a day vendor experience, we hear from customers whether their product is should be supported for, a provisional status or eventually a vendor member status. Mm. So it's a graduated experience. But also I do want to say that we also have our longest running vendor for our 40th years, Lewis Creek Farm.
Mm.
They've been there even though he does retail and wholesale, I would say, those are a lot of vendors who are there for a long time. And I thought one comment I would like to say is that, Shelburne Farm, they're there.
Yes, they
and
are.
They decided to be present because they just still want to make people aware that Shelburne Farms was open. Whether they got sales or not, it was important for people to know that that place was accessible to folks.
Yeah.
So I think that was a really wonderful part of this experience.
Yeah, Lewis Creek was just at your pre-Christmas. Made sure I got some wonderful greens, some great fingerling potatoes. I can go on and on. And the other thing is we take possession. We like to say I had a friend who used to come over from – let's see, Danville to Burlington for her mushroom guy. And that's Amir with these wonderful shiitake mushrooms that taste like butter. I had to search for this mushroom guy. There's a little table set up there. But I'm like that. I say I have, I have a this person, a that person. At Winooski Farmers Market, I got a paella guy. But I want to talk less about me and more about the two of you and your markets. Now, Farm to Plate is developing a 10-year strategic plan, and one of the areas is farmers markets. I wondered if you've looked at what they've recommended. There were things like $500,000 for a statewide campaign, money for two positions to manage a centralized resources and marketing strategy. They also talk about establishing 8 flagship farmers markets. Cindy, have you seen this, and what do you think about it?
I have seen it, but it's been a number of months since I have, so I don't think I can be too articulate about it. But I do think that the time is ripe for really trying to make an investment in farmers markets such as this would represent. Mm-hmm. This whole brand identity that Mieko speaks so well about, I think, is very important. The Vermont brand, local brand, all that kind of thing. I also think that, we have been so fortunate that Nova Vermont has provided support to farmers markets, but they have one part, it's like 10 hours a week. And so if we really had, a couple of people that really could provide technical support to farmers markets and also, embracing this body of work around brand identity and publicity and helping farmers market, as Mieko talked about, joining the 21st century, I think that could do a lot for us here in Vermont.
Mieko, any thoughts on that 10-year strategy from Farm to Plate?
Right. So this is actually the second iteration or second strategic plan, and that's kind of builds on the first 10 years of the food system. And I think this time it builds around, particularly for the direct market, the fact that we need more kind of centralization of resources, because every farmer's market operates as its own little organization and business. And it's hard. There's a lot of turnover when it comes to management as well as, staffing and locations. And so there's a nice consideration with all those recommendations about, how are things marketed at statewide, providing some technical resources. Those are the things that are needed, a little bit more of a system. And we see that as examples in like California and New York, the bigger markets. But it's really interesting because having those centralized services are going to be helpful overall to the whole state.
Cindy Walcott, anything that you learned this year that should be used in future years?
One of the things, this isn't answering your question exactly, but one of the things that I would like to mention is the importance of farmers markets to low-income Vermonters.
Yes. You there, Cindy?
If you are a Three Squares Vermont recipient, you can use your benefit at the farmers market. And so this year, as Vermont families struggle, that became an important resource. But it's not one that a lot of people know about.
Mm-hmm.
We also have Crop Cash, which is a resource that doubles your Three Squares benefit. And as a matter of fact, it ended up tripling it this year because Nova Vermont had some extra funds to use during the latter months of the market. So I just really feel, I'm hoping that Farm to Plate doesn't sort of emphasize the sort of higher income customers, but also really seeks to let lower income Vermonters know that they can shop at farmers markets too.
That is an outstanding point, a great way to connect them with farmers and fresh food, which is really important for the recipients in that program. I totally agree, and I'm glad you brought that up, Cindy. Thank you very much. Mieko, we're almost out of time, but have you been able to speak to your vendors who sat out this year and what they're thinking about next year?
Yeah, I mean, some of them are thinking about coming back now that they've seen all of the guidance put into place. I think also what's wonderful has been during this time has been seeing how other vendors care for one another. So the ones who are present are also representing some of the vendors who aren't present. And that's through delivery services that they've come up with. You know, I can think of Maple Wind Farm and Thousand Stone. They came up with delivery services to sell all those other products so that you're not detached from, you know, those who weren't present.
Absolutely. Yeah, this week or your Christmas, Maple Wind had a bunch of bags ready to go. People had ordered in advance, and they could just swing around the side of the line and grab their pre-order. It was a pretty wonderful thing. So Cindy Walcott is the past president of the Champlain Islands Farmers Market, and Mieko Ozeki is the former market director of the Burlington Farmers Market and is an advisory board member of the Vermont Farmers Market Association. What a pleasure to have you both on Vermont Viewpoint today. Thank you.
Thank you.
CBS News is next, and then we'll be back with national correspondent Bob Ney. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and we usually hear from our next guest on Friday mornings at this time, but hey, tomorrow's New Year's Day, so national correspondent Bob Ney is with us today. Bob, great to have you back with us again.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
Happy New Year, hoping to see the end of 2020 because of COVID. We should start with right. COVID by the numbers, Bob.
Yes, sir. And we have worldwide, these are the cases as of 6:15, actually yesterday, we have 82 million, approximately 510,000 worldwide cases, 1,800,400 deaths. That's worldwide. And the U.S. is 19,679,000 cases, so we have far less cases. But our total deaths are 341,000. So if you look at the worldwide deaths of, you know, 1,800,000, we're still way up there, obviously, for the proportion, you know, of what we are to the world in population.
Looks like about 16-17% doing right. the quick math. Bob, we've been rolling out the vaccine, so how has the distribution been going? Seems like there's some hiccups.
You know, I mean, it's out there and it's beginning, and that gives people, I think, a lot of hope, but it's slower than they thought. And also they've had cases, for example, in Milwaukee, Rick, there was 500 doses that had to be discarded because they were refrigerated. And then in southeastern Arizona, a rural clinic has enough shots, but too few employees lining up to take them. And then physicians in Maine are really in the dark when they're going to get vaccinated. So each state seems to be a little bit different. I mean, overall, are they getting out there? Yes. Is it slower than they thought? Yes. But I just wanted to mention my home state real quick, Rick. Meanwhile, in Ohio, it's sort of no thanks to the shot in the sense that our governor, Mike DeWine, really is kind of in shock. 60% of nursing home workers who have been offered this vaccine in Ohio have refused it. 60%.
Is there an explanation for that, why they would not take the shot?
No, nothing that we know of. I mean, I'm sure there'll be some follow-up stories to this. The governor said it's not clear, you know, he's not imposing a requirement. I guess maybe some reluctancy, but, you know, if our deaths in Ohio have been, just like the nation, large amounts of deaths and also people contracting it, obviously in nursing homes. So I would think that, you know, they would be, you know, people that would want to, you know, obviously get the vaccine, but it doesn't seem to be that way.
Wow, that is shocking. And
that's shocking.
Look forward to hearing. Hopefully that turns around and people do start taking the shot in a place that's quite vulnerable. Let's turn our attention to 600 or 2,000. These two numbers have become very popular in the last week.
Right.
Should Americans get $600 or $2,000? What's going on with this now?
Well, I'm hearing, you know, everything under the sun of people that, you know, are either for or against, but most certainly are for. But, you know, what ended up happening was the president came out and said, hey, I think it ought to be 2,000 plus get rid of some wasteful spending that were in some of the bills. You know, the foreign money is what's mainly been talked about, of course, Rick, you know, across the country here and there and across the social media. But the result was that the House moved very quickly, said, sure, here's 2,000. And then the Senate was having a growing amount of Republican senators, including Marco Rubio. He's one of the more famous ones in Florida that said, yes, we want to do this. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, said, well, we're not going to do it. He stopped, actually, Senator Schumer, the Democratic leader's motion to bring it up for a vote. And he said, I want to do this in a package, which McConnell is introducing himself, which would have the 2,000, but it would also have some changes that originally the president wanted in law, including the liability issue for tech companies is one of those issues. Now, that, I guess you could say, well, McConnell's going to go ahead and he's for the 2,000, but the way he has done this, Rick, this means that there's no way this is going to make this in time. It's done till the next Congress. And what's very interesting about this, there's two Senate races in Georgia.
Right.
You and I have talked about this on your show. Mm-hmm. Both Republicans have come out right out front and said, we want the 2,000, but McConnell's not bringing it to a vote. Now, I'm just putting myself back in the shoes of when I, you know, ran for office. And if I were the opponents, I would say, okay, you know, you're promising the 2,000, but you're not doing anything to make McConnell, your leader, do something. This might have an impact. This is such a tight race in these two races in Georgia. This may very well, which would be interesting, if this makes the difference and McConnell loses those two seats because he didn't bring the bill up, it'll be interesting because he won't be the leader anymore.
That's very interesting, and see how that unfolds. That race, I know there's been a lot of early voting there and absentee, and is Tuesday election day there in Georgia?
Yes, it's on. Is that the 5th? I haven't had my calendar.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Tuesday then.
All right, and then the 6th is a big day. That should be when Joe Biden clears the final hurdle, but there still could be a little bit of excitement in Washington.
Well, there's going to be, I have a little personal history on these because it's been twice called for a vote to dispute the electoral or to question the electoral college, you know, confirmation on the floor of the House and Senate. And I was involved in the second one, actually. Vice President Cheney took a break. I went to the podium and I called the state of Ohio to get the electors, which was the exact amount in 2005 that put Bush over into the presidency, you know. Mm-hmm. As soon as I did, Stephanie Tubbs Jones from Ohio, she's passed away now, said I dispute the vote, and we went into debate, and then it went to the Senate. Senator Boxer had done that. I think in the end, if my memory serves me right, 37 maybe Democrats went ahead and voted against it. The rest of the Democrats voted for Bush. So I've been there, done that. It's happened twice, you know, in America. And what's going to happen on the 6th, it's going to be protested in the House. They will then go into floor speeches, and then there'll be a vote, and then the House will confirm Joe Biden as president. It will go to the Senate, which Mitch McConnell did not want any Republicans to protest this, but he didn't get his wish. Senator Hawley is going to protest it, so the same procedure, a bunch of floor debate, and then Joe Biden will be confirmed, by the way, with Republican votes.
There we go.
In the Senate, yes.
All right, and all the drama should end. So by next week, we'll know what the Senate count is, and Joe Biden will probably be headed to the White House. So as we've cleaned up everything here in the States, let's cross the pond where they're cleaning things up, and let's take a look at now that the agreement has been forged between Britain and the EU, a post-Brexit world. What do we have in store there?
Well, this is very interesting because talk about coming down to the deadline. It literally did.
Yeah.
And Boris Johnson's government and the European Union have signed a law. And, of course, Queen Elizabeth II has endorsed it. And it went into three major points that they were talking about, which was basically trade and, you know, how you do fishing rights and a level playing field on subsidies and regulations, and also a mechanism to resolve disputes. So it looks like they've got everything agreed to, and there will be zero tariffs, interesting, between the European Union and between the United Kingdom. Now the last step, the Queen inks it, and then it goes to the European Union, and they have to look it over because this thing came out, and I don't think anybody's read it, to be honest with you. It was so fast, which happens in America. I'm not going to criticize the UK for what we do.
You're right.
But the bottom line, Rick, is that it's going to probably be signed off by the European Union, and that staves off a lot of problems. I mean, this cost the last prime minister her job.
Yeah, it did. Theresa May. And they made their deadline. We missed ours here in the U.S., the census deadline. Why is that important, Bob?
Well, it's important because the census does so many things. First of all, it gives states the amount of people that they have, you know, within the state, which then allows them to have their formulas, which affects you and me back home for the counties, our counties, the local governments, to know how many people they have. And when community development monies come down, they use that as a basis for many things, housing funding, community development block grants, you know, et cetera. So that's, you know, one reason, obviously, it's very important. And the second is a political reason, because this is how they say, here's how many people are now in your state, and here are the congressional seats you have, and then you, the states, carve them up. And you can't do that carving reapportionment until you have the census. So it's good for, you know, a lot of different reasons. But, of course, there was a court action against the Trump administration who didn't want to count, you know, people that were not here in a legal basis, and that was a court action that was thrown out. But basic bottom line is they just didn't get it done in time. So now it will maybe lapse into Biden's time as president. We don't know yet. Trump administration may be able to get it done. We're just not sure.
Bob Nay, thank you so much for your insight on these stories that are shaping our world.
Happy New Year to you and your great listeners.
All right. Talk to you again next Friday. 7 days took a look back at the highlights in Vermont arts this year. And Pamela Poulston is here to tell us about it. Pamela is the co-founder and co-editor of 7 days and associate publisher. Pamela, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rick.
Pamela, how crippling was the pandemic, or is, to Vermont's creative sector?
Oh, it's bad. as you mentioned, it took a, you know, there was a lot of blows one after the other. And you're right that the creative sector got creative in their response to it. But financially speaking, it was very, very challenging and still is. Vermont Arts Council and other nonprofits really jumped in quickly to try to get funding, and of course the federal response in the spring really helped, and so a lot of money was distributed to artists, and they're still divvying up some money, but it's not enough. It's not anywhere near enough for people to, you know, actually make a living. And a lot of the kinds of day jobs that some artists have also disappeared. So sure. I can only imagine what a struggle it's been.
There was CARES Act money, and which you kind of referred to. And were there other organizations that stepped in to kind of help artists in this time of need?
Well, as I mentioned, the Vermont Arts Council, you know, a large part of its mission is to help artists and small arts organizations in that way. And so they continue to dispense grants to individuals and to other organizations through the federal money and some state allocated money and also donations. Mm-hmm. And then Vermont Humanities has been involved. There's an organization called CERF Plus, C-E-R-F, and it is based in Vermont, and their mission is really to be a safety net, a financial safety net. I think of it as like the arts version of a food shelf.
Right.
And their mission is to hand out really funds to artists all the time, and so that certainly they stepped up for pandemic relief for artists as well.
They really are, yeah, that safety net, you know, that provide bridge funding for artists when they need it. And, of course, that was well needed during these months since March. If you would, let's dance, Paula. What were some creative ways dance companies tours jetaient through this tough year?
I would say dance companies, like every performing arts, performing artist, learned how to do things online and also learned how to do things sometimes in public, but socially distanced. And I think I have to say that I think that learning to do things online, learning recording skills and everything involved with the technology of dispensing performance online, it is absolutely no replacement for, performing for a live audience. But I think people really, one of the ways that they really pivoted was to reinvent themselves in the virtual space. And I will say one positive thing about that, I think these skills are not going to go away when and if the pandemic does. People have really learned a lot. And for someone who consumes a lot of performance and visual art, I think it's fantastic to be able to see things from pretty much all over the world now.
Mm-hmm.
The downside for the performance is that the monetary aspect has not kept up. So people are kind of expecting to see this stuff for free or very little money.
And when it is shown,
we haven't figured that part out yet.
Yeah, it's kind of like media when it first went online. We could put all our stories online, but how do we get compensated for doing that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The opera company of Middlebury was one of the little stories that we did a follow up on in our art section in this week's paper. And Doug Anderson, who's the director of that company, he's also the artistic director of Town Hall Theater in Middlebury, and he said, we're learning how video can help tell these stories. And so this year, for the first time ever, the opera company of Middlebury did a streaming micro opera. It's only 10 minutes long. And the beauty of it, of course, is that singers don't have to be spewing particles at anybody. They can perform in their own spaces and, the tech people sew it all together into a pretty amazing presentation for viewers. This particular opera happened to be an unusual subject. It's about the story of some 20,000 Chinese workers who helped to build the U.S. Transcontinental Railroad. And, of course, they were basically screwed in the end because they were Chinese. So it tells an important story, and it's actually pretty timely given the immigration debacles of this past year. But to that point, this is a format that they now know how to do and will probably continue to do even after being able to return to live performance.
That is wonderful.
It may open up some possibilities for people.
Yeah, it is wonderful to think, how in times of desperation like this, that we do come up with creative ways, and going forward, they will definitely be part of our culture from now on. Other company that got really creative was Northern Stage. So tell us about what they did.
They are a really good example of everything I was just talking about.
Yeah.
Northern Stage, which is based in White River Junction, is just a world-class theater company. And their artistic director, Carol Dunn, said to me, we've pivoted so many times, we are now tap dancers. when things shut down in March, mid-March, I think it was like within 2 weeks, they had created this series, a weekly series on Zoom called Playdate, very clever name, And it was both performance-oriented but also educational. So, you know, people who are really theater geeks could watch and then watch some performers, actors, read scenes from plays, and then they would stop and they would discuss it. So, as Carol put it, they took a deep dive into these plays and really talked about them. So that was cool. And I think they did about 12 of those in the spring and the summer. And then they decided to put on a live performance mm-hmm. in the Barrett Center for the Arts in White River. That's a 240-seat theater. And, of course, because of social distancing, they could only have a fraction of that many people. I think they had something like 30 people a night coming to watch this one-woman play.
Mm-hmm.
It was a recent Dartmouth College graduate named Stephanie Everett, and she wrote a play called It's Fine, I'm Fine, and so she also performed it. But I think a week into that performance, the governor basically shut the border of Vermont, and so Carol said suddenly they only had 8 people in theater per night. But they did also videotape it for viewing online later and proceeded to do that minus the live performance. They did some streaming of a few other shows that they called Tiny Necessary Theater.
Right.
Carol told me that it turned out to be huge, exhausting theater because it was just as much work to, you know, come up with these, create them, and do all the tech and everything else to present them. But they just did such great work. And I have to give a plug for the one that is still on right now. They did a radio play version of It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
I haven't seen that movie in like 100 years. But I have to say I really enjoyed it as a radio play. So I listened to it. I just brought my laptop down to the kitchen and listened to it while I was cooking one night. And it was really fun. Just to hear the voices and imagine the rest of it. You know, it was like the 1930s, except it was on a laptop.
These are all things that Northern Stage has been putting on. And props to you. I really loved your review of It's Fine, I'm Fine that was done at Northern Stage. How difficult will scheduling live events become for the arts once we get the all clear to kind of ramp up again?
That's a really great question. I mean, you know, obviously performing arts, especially people who present whole seasons like the Flynn Theater, do this years in advance. You know, there's a lot of advance planning for putting shows together. This year, a lot of things were in pop-up form. So maybe people will continue to do that, pop-up meaning, you know, we planned this over a week, and now we're going to perform this in City Hall Park.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some of that might happen, but I think it's going to be really difficult for theater companies to sort of, you know, rev the engines again and get going. And it remains to be seen what kind of financial shape they're going to be in.
Mm, good point.
So that's worrisome. One thing I just wanted to say quickly that really made a comeback this summer, as you know, was drive-in movies.
Yes.
And also drive-in concerts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're probably going to see more of that. Why not? It was fun. You know, people do want to get together, even if they have to stay 6 feet apart.
It is very interesting that out of what has been a very dark year, we're going to have some positive things and drive-in movie theaters being kind of resurrected as a venue is one of those, and that's kind of great. Pamela Polston is co-founder and co-editor of 7 Days. Pam, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. All right, we're going to take a minute to listen to the CBS News update, and then we'll be back to talk with Alan Keyes of VT Digger about his recent Tarnished Badge series. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. There's been a lot of focus placed on law enforcement agencies around the country this year and here in Vermont. There have been movements to defund police departments and to create better oversight of their activities. VT Digger's Alan Keyes recently took a deep dive into what happens to law enforcement officers whose truthfulness has been called into question. The answers he found can vary pretty widely. Alan Keyes joins us now to talk about what he learned in researching this series. Alan, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Listeners, if you've read the series and have some observations or questions for Alan Keyes, give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Alan, what were you trying to learn when you started investigating this series?
Well, it originally started by trying to do public records requests into misconduct of police officers from various departments here in Vermont, and continually getting blocked at that because they would continually say, like, it's a personnel matter and these documents would not be available. And so I was aware that the prosecutors had issued these letters over time called Brady letters. They're often called Giglio letters too, and they get their name from national cases that have to do with the requirement on prosecutors to turn over evidence to defense that may help prove a person's innocence or lead to a lesser sentence. And I knew that these letters were out there, and so I did a public records request to all of the 14 state's attorneys to see what types of cases they have issued Brady letters on, calling into question officers' credibility.
Was there a particular case or cases that prompted you into looking into this?
No, not a particular case. I just knew that over time from covering the courts, I had seen like two or three of these letters over the years, and they seem to have spelled out in more detail about what misconduct might have taken place involving an officer. So I thought this was a way to get an idea or a sense about what types of things were happening as far as misconduct here in Vermont.
Who issues the Brady letter, and when does it get issued?
A prosecutor, a state's attorney, there's 14 in Vermont, issues a Brady letter. And what prompts it is if there's an issue of credibility, dishonesty, or bias that would affect a person, credibly testifying on the stand in the case. And so the prosecution has to turn that evidence over to a defense attorney, so that way the defense attorney can represent their client and potentially raise these issues when it comes to either proving their client's innocence or perhaps a lesser sentence for their client if this officer were involved in that particular case.
What types of wrongdoing will get you a Brady letter issued to an officer?
Lying during an internal investigation was one. There were issues of a lot of them seem to be coming up because of searches where an officer does a search and then writes an affidavit kind of what went on. But then later on, the prosecutor or defense attorney looks at the video, the body cam video or dash cam video, and finds contradictions.
It seems as if there are some rather, I'll call them soft incidents that can get you placed on this list or get a Brady letter issued. I'm thinking of one in particular, there was an egging report sometimes reporting errors. So describe how someone got a Brady letter for something that seemed fairly inconsequential.
Yeah, there was a Brady letter issued in the case, the egging incident that you mentioned. In that case, a homeowner had reported that his house had been vandalized by some teens who had egged his house. And the officer had responded, had the names of the teens, and they had worked out an agreement with the teens, the homeowner, and the officer, that the teens would kind of work off what the damage that they had done by painting the house. And the homeowner agreed to it. But then later on, the homeowner found out that the work was not done properly and some of the kids weren't participating. So that led to him, the homeowner, wanting to bring charges forward. And one of the teams involved a fellow officer to the one who had investigated the case. So when the homeowner went back and tried to bring forward charges again, the investigating officer had not properly done the paperwork in that case, and so that hindered the investigation. So that officer was issued a Brady letter for not properly handling the case, and also raised the issue of, was that officer covering up for the other officer's teen son who was involved in that digging incident?
Wow. How did you acquire the information on when Brady letters have been issued?
I did a public records request to each of the 14 state's attorneys, as well as to the state office of state attorneys, and I received them back. For some, it took a while to get the letters back. For them, it seemed like it took a while for some to find them. Others just turned them out and just emailed me back almost within hours of getting them. Several departments had, or several state attorneys had zero Brady letters that they have issued over time, while other state attorneys have issued many more, you know, over a half dozen, and one as many as nine letters.
I was speaking with Alan Keyes of VT Digger about his Tarnished Badge series. It's a three-part series. And Alan, is there any centralized system maintaining who's on this list and for what?
No, there is no system for maintaining who's on these lists. And that's part of what I found from doing this series and looking into this. I thought I could go to one place and find out, get a centralized list of who's on this, who have had Brady letters issued against them, as well as for what reason. But that was not the case. You have to go to each of the 14 state's attorneys. And in some cases, there have been turnover in state's attorneys. So getting them from the previous state's attorney, there is no system for kind of a handoff of Brady letters within offices of the state's attorneys. And so that was something that I found out by doing the story.
Wow. Is there any consistency as to when a Brady letter will get issued to an officer?
No, there is no consistency. In Rutland County, the prosecutor there, we looked at over 5 years here in Vermont of Brady letters being issued, and there are 28 total that had been issued, and nine were in one county, in Rutland County, from the prosecutor, state's attorney Rose Kennedy. And, you know, other counties such as Franklin County, which is similar in size to Rutland County, had issued zero. And it seems like the prosecutors have been using different standards for issuing them. I know Rose Kennedy in Rutland County had talked about having a kind of a broad view about when these should be turned over, pointing to those kind of guiding cases, the Brady case and the Giglio case, as making sure that the defense got all the information it could have to properly defend their clients.
Alan Keyes, what exactly is in a Brady letter?
Well, that also differs from state attorney to state attorney, depending who writes them. Some of them that I've seen, and we have posted to our website, all 28 of them, are as short as like just a couple sentences, just saying that their credibility has been called into question and they're notifying the defense. And these letters are sent to the defense bar and throughout the whole county that the state attorney practices in. Others are quite lengthy and can involve several pages explaining an incident that also come with attachments that might have involved investigations that went into what led to getting the Brady letter. So, again, it seems to be more inconsistency in the process.
Are there severe consequences to having a Brady letter issued to you?
Yeah, I mean, some police officers refer to them as kind of a scarlet letter, and other people refer to being on that list or getting a letter as kind of being on the do not call list, because if you do get a Brady letter, your credibility is called into question, and that can, in some cases, result in a prosecutor no longer taking cases from that officer because they don't want to have that officer investigating a case and then they can't take it to court and have that officer testify and have a jury believe it, or have a defense attorney bring up the previous issue with the officer's credibility that could hinder another case that might be pending, particularly when it involves a serious crime.
Let's take a call from Fred, who's joining us from Newbury. Good morning, Fred. What's your question or comment?
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is, or comment is, police are not required to tell the truth. That's it, in a nutshell. The only place you're supposed to tell the truth is in a court of law, and sometimes they even lie there. And if they get caught, usually it depends on what the judge wants to do. But if you've ever watched these true crime things on television, you see them in the interrogation room, and you can tell the police are just lying. Well, for instance, well, Joe just said that you were there, and Joe never said that. Yet, and the guy being interrogated doesn't know that.
Mm. Fred, let me put this to our guest, Alan Keyes. Is it incumbent that an officer always tells the truth in a case, especially in an interrogation situation?
I don't know about that, but I know in the cases of the Brady letters that I saw and people who appeared on these lists, most of them were the result of sworn statements that officers have issued. Sworn statements are under the penalty of perjury. So in those cases, that's when I saw many of the Brady letters issued. And like I said, they involved, several of them involved an officer writing in a sworn statement one thing in an affidavit in support of a criminal charge when a video appeared to show something different.
Mm. Has there been any move to create a centralized system? You mentioned earlier you had to go to all 14 states' attorneys to find these Brady letters. Anything happening to centralize this?
Well, I talked to a lot of lawyers and the state's attorneys, and they said that many of them said that they would like to see a centralized system for this. Several of them said they don't like the process of doing these, either because it puts them in an uncomfortable position, because oftentimes the prosecutors work closely with the police in their community. So it also brings up the issue of conflict of interest. Will a prosecutor not issue a Brady letter to an officer who she knows or works with closely versus another officer in the community? So some officers or some prosecutors wanted to get rid of that kind of conflict that they know is inherent in that process. And they would like to see a centralized system, having one entity in the state. And there's some people talked about having one lawyer or one person appointed to this job who would decide when to issue Brady letters. Other people have talked about including a civilian oversight component to it, such as having a panel of community members involved in that process of deciding when Brady letters would be issued. Other state's attorneys I talked to wanted to continue to have the power within their jurisdiction, just within their jurisdiction, because they talked about the fact that they were elected officials within that community, and they were elected to, do the prosecutorial functions, and they believed that that was part of their job, was to do this, and they didn't want to relinquish that authority to some other centralized entity.
Alan, can a police officer continue their law enforcement career once they've received a Brady letter?
Yeah, in fact, quite a few of them have, including three that became police chiefs or are currently police chiefs here in Vermont. And the prosecutor in two of those said that she continues to take cases from those two officers because while she thought it was important to notify the defense about these issues, she believed that the officers could explain exactly what took place and that a jury would find them believable in explaining exactly how this Brady letter came to be and the incident that led to the question of credibility. But the state's attorney said even though she found those officers credible, she did see it as her obligation to let the defense attorney know about these incidents.
Hmm. What about... It can happen, a second Brady letter being issued to the same officer.
Well, in one case, there was an officer in Rutland who got a Brady letter, and he ended up resigning from the Rutland City Police Department. But then the Castleton Police Department, which is kind of a neighboring community to Castleton, that's a Rutland, hired that officer. And knowing the police chief knew that that person had a Brady letter, but said he was, the police chief said he was in favor of giving people second chances, and thought that maybe it was a mistake that the other officer, that the officer had just committed a mistake and was not intentional in what he had done with the first Brady letter. And so we hired that officer, and shortly thereafter, that officer presented a case to the state's attorney, and in a sworn statement regarding a search, the information in the affidavit was again different than what was appearing in the on the video. And the state's attorney wrote to the police chief saying she would no longer be taking cases from that officer. And then the officer, I guess they described it as a mutual parting of the ways between the Castleton Police Department and that officer. And that officer is no longer in law enforcement.
You mentioned that Rutland's state's attorney has issued 9 of these Brady letters. Are there counties where the state's attorney has issued none? And do they can they explain why they've never gone this route?
Yeah, I mean, Franklin County has not issued any, which, again, is kind of roughly the same size as Rutland County, I guess. And Bennington County has also not issued any in their county. And I talked to Erica Marthage, who's the state's attorney in Bennington County, and she talked about instances that she said she would have issued Brady letters on, including one where a officer was having allegedly having sex with an informant or a witness in a drug case, and she was going to issue a Brady letter in that case, but the officer ended up resigning or getting terminated prior to that action. And so she said a Brady letter was not warranted because that officer would not be called to testify in a case. So she did not need to write a Brady letter in that case, she said. And she gave other examples where officers had not been credible, but she pointed out that in each of those cases, those officers left law enforcement. And so she did not believe that a Brady letter was warranted, again, because those officers would not be investigating cases or be called to testify in cases.
The Brady letter is not just a Vermont thing. It's a national program. So are there standards that exist from state to state?
Different states have different ways of tracking them. I know New Hampshire has kind of a centralized list, but there's a court case. They call it the Lorries list in New Hampshire. I guess named after a case involving a credibility issue. Mm-hmm. And in that case, I know there's several, the names on the list are not public. And I know several press organizations in Vermont, in New Hampshire, are engaged in a court case currently to try and get those records released so people know exactly who's on the list. I believe in New Hampshire you can only find out, like, if an officer in your department is on the list. Like, if I wanted to find out if an officer in Montpelier was on the list, they would just tell me there's, like, 2 officers on the list. They wouldn't provide the name of the officer or the reasons.
Alan Keyes, since this... Go ahead.
I was going to say other states have centralized lists for finding them all in one place.
And since this series started running, have you heard from state's attorneys or law enforcement agencies about this program, about the Brady's list, the Brady's letter?
I mean, I heard from some officers who claim that I'm picking on police, and then I've heard from others who say that more officers should be receiving Brady letters. Hmm. I also heard from people who think that this brought out an issue that maybe will lead to the creation of a centralized system or list. There's actually websites out there, like BradyList.com type websites, that track these around the country and have lists of the officers.
Interesting. It'll be interesting to hear what the AG's office responds to your pieces. Alan Keyes writes for VT Digger, recently published the 3-part series called Tarnished Badge. You can read the series at vtdigger.org. Alan Keyes, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks, Rick.
And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and was directed by Lee Cattell. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. And I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday. Yeah.